Hello, everybody, and welcome to podcast number 28 of the Alexis L podcast. And so our last podcast, 27, was Phil Bevan, and it was all about shenanigans in the Labour Party, right-wing shenanigans and left-wing shenanigans in a way.
Yeah.
In the Labour Party. And it's been a bit of a hit with our community, would you say, Talal?
That's right. You were shedding some concerns that it would rival Saul Williams for our lowest hits, which has always been unfair. It's not like we often get, because you mention it so much, we often get praise for that episode.
Yeah.
If you haven't heard it, go back and listen to the Saul Williams. Yeah. It's different to all the other episodes we do because it's exploring a life of this man who is very unrelated to the world of the podcast apart from your brief interaction with him 10 or so years ago.
Yeah.
However, as well as all the praise we've had for the Blind Boy podcast we've had, which is to be expected, you'll be happy to hear we've got so many nice things being said about the Phil Bevan episode. And here's some examples from our Twitter following.
Okay.
Follow us on Twitter at AlexisSalePod, the same as our Instagram handle. Being of Earth says, can't praise this enough. To me, this excellent discussion clearly shows why we must totally abandon the Labour Party and Westminster politics. Emma W. says, great listen, thanks. Now I'm looking forward to the Houses of Parliament being turned into a museum. See where I'm going with this? I think she wants our next gig to be there. Andrew Watts. This one's nice. I get Alexi is very conscious about dedicating too much of the show towards politics. I wouldn't say very conscious. He does it quite a lot. But I've listened to every show so far. And in my opinion, this was the most energetic and funniest I've heard Alexi. Great guest in Phil Bevan. Good listen. Thumbs up emoji.
Yeah, it's interesting that he was... that people thought I interacted well with him, really, because he's not, you know, he's a neophyte in terms of broadcasting, isn't he? You know?
John Tognolini.
Tognolini.
Says, this recent episode of Alexis L's podcast is focused on Jeremy Corbyn, who was the best prime minister the UK never had.
Mm.
A relevance to Australia, as we still go through the Albo honeymoon period.
Mm.
Compare Jez's anti-imperialism with Albo's silence on Julian Assange.
Yes, indeed. I think he was vocal when before he was Prime Minister, Albanese. But did I tell the story of the last time? No, was it the last time? No, when I was touring Australia one time, and I was on the Australian, I ended up, you know, like you do anything, you don't know what, I ended up on Australian kind of Question Time.
Just promoting your show kind of thing.
But I was also, you know, forced to kind of...
I do remember this story.
Yeah. Did I say it on the air, on the podcast?
Well, remind us. It's been a while.
I found myself declaiming at great length about Tasmanian coal mining policy. Yeah, with great authority. Yeah, what they should do is, but my memory is that Albanese was a guest on that show as well and seemed quite, you know, for a politician, seemed funny and, you know.
Yeah,
which I'm not. Is more than you can say for most of them, really. But obviously, I seem to remember when he was in opposition or when he was, that he was quite vocal in support of Assange, but now perhaps less so now he's in power, which is tends to be the way of these things, isn't it?
So rather than go on there and just kind of proclaim your ignorance, you doubled down and just dug in deep in local politics.
Just a range of I think I probably said I'm not really qualified to comment on this, but it didn't stop me.
In terms of the Twitter, I think you get the idea. Well, Paul Granger says, I love your podcast, but very frustrating to hear attacks on genuine socialists like John McDonnell and Owen Jones.
Mm.
Ironic, given you made jokes about the People's Front of Judea. Socialists need to stick together. Well, thanks, Paul. I don't know about that, because if they're of Israel, then they're not real socialists, really, is right?
Well, that's what Phil Bevan would say. I don't know. It's... I mean, in a sense, I don't necessarily take a position, certainly in terms of this podcast, that this is what he was saying. And I certainly have a degree of sympathy. I agree that it is problematic, though, that, you know, that you know, Owen Jones or John McDonald are certainly, you know, identify as socialists. But on the other hand, do they ultimately advance the cause or not? I mean, Phil Bevin would certainly maintain, I think, that they didn't really. And will a, you know, a broader front, not being factional, you know, in the end produce a desired effect, or will it lead to the, you know, the kind of the movement constantly being betrayed?
And it's a tale as old as time, because, you know, lefties have always been factional like that.
Yeah.
Hence why the Life of Brian joke is so present still.
Yeah.
It's an ancient, you know, I'm reading now a book about bloody anarchists in early 20th century Paris, and they could never agree on anything, even though they all hated the state.
Yeah.
It's like the ego anarchists, the individualist anarchists, and then like the socialist anarchists, and they all fucking hated each other and would have fights and often kill each other. And it's like, it's always been like that. At least we're not killing each other now. But right-wing people, they stick together despite their differences, because they all take power at any...
Because they're evil, yeah.
At any cost. At least we're more honest about our misgivings with each other.
But yeah, I guess, tricky... I don't know. I'd say it's a debate. I mean, I see my function here is to really to initiate debate rather than to take a rigid position. But... having said that, I also mentioned on the last on the Phil Bevin show about how I've got somebody in now to talk about a completely different way of doing left politics and a way of doing less left politics that may avoid those problems of factionalism and internal That's dissent. Right.
Speaking of anarchists as well.
This guy is great.
Who have we got on today, Alexei?
So we have got now, please listen to my guest, Karn Ross. Hi, everybody. My guest today is Karn Ross. And just if anybody's got the idea of me as a kind of outsider figure living on the margins of society, I actually met Karn once before at a book group, partly run by my friend Horatia Lawson. And it was in lovely, lovely people in the book group. You were a member, although you were just leaving because you were moving to Wales at the time. Yeah. I haven't been back since. I don't think they were quite my people, but they seemed absolutely delightful. Really.
Yeah, they were real book people. They really knew their stuff, which I found a bit intimidating. And they were all women, so I was doubly intimidated.
Yes. I hadn't read the book either, so I thought, but, you know, I think I'm still on their WhatsApp group, so I still spy on them, but I've never been back since. Nevertheless, I thought that Karn was a fascinating character then, and I always wanted to talk more to him. A little while ago, I also signed a letter of protest about Rojava in northern Syria, along with Noam Chomsky and various other left-wing people. And Karn, I think, sent that out, or you were a signatory?
I was just a signatory.
But yeah. Rojava is somewhere that I have been fascinated by for a while. And so I just contacted Karn and wanted to talk to him about that. But also, I mean, I know that you've had a remarkable kind of career path, as it were. So we can talk about how you started out, I suppose, what you did. And then eventually we'll get to Rojava, I think. So,
sure.
Karn Ross, welcome to the Alexei Tell podcast.
Thank you, Alexei.
You're welcome. So, what up with that? So, you know, everything. Tell me everything.
Well, I mean, it's great to talk about Rojava because, in a way, it is, in some senses, a real model of how to live. It's not a perfect model, and there are a lot. There's a lot to say about it, its current conditions today, and over the last 10 years, but. For me, as for many people, it's kind of an apotheosis of how we see politics needing to go. I'm an anarchist now, rather ironically, because I started off as a government servant. I was a British diplomat for 14 years. I resigned over the Iraq war. I was Britain's Iraq expert at the UN Security Council, and I knew that my country lied about the war. So that was the end of my official career, and I've been on a political journey since then, that has led me to anarchism. And one can describe what's going on in Rojava as a version of anarchism. It's a kind of gentle communalist version of anarchism. But it represents, for me and for many people, a real exemplar of a good way to live, a good way to run society. So I went there in 2015, I think it was. Sorry, I should remember. And had a really amazing visit there and got to meet a lot of people.
Maybe we should say what it is, first of all.
Yeah.
Or you're planning to get to that.
Sure. It's a corner of northeast Syria that is largely Kurdish, but not by any means solely Kurdish. And it has been self-governing since about 2012. And that's 10 years now. It came about because of the Syrian civil war, which followed Assad's gruesome repression of his own people after the Arab Spring in Syria, where what happened was the Kurds essentially took control of northeast Syria and have been running it ever since, and have instituted a remarkable system of self-government, bottom-up self-government there, which we can talk more about. But it's important to understand that it came about because of the Syrian civil war, because the country, the authority of the regime had essentially been destroyed in that area of Syria, allowing this remarkable political project to take place. And there's long antecedents for it. It didn't just spring out of nothing. And there's an ideological antecedent to it, and there's an organizational antecedent to it, both of which I think are worth knowing about for our own context, because political change doesn't just happen. It has to be prepared for. Similar lessons from the Spanish Civil War as well, the anarchist experiment there.
Well, yes, and there's also, I think, the other thing that I'm very much resistant to the kind of main man kind of theory of history, but there is in a sense, there is a main man in this story, which is Abdul Öcalan. And to talk about his terrible word, but his journey, I think, from kind of conventional Marxist, Leninist, revolutionary and, in a sense, maybe terrorist, or, you know, I don't know whether you'd accept that description, freedom fighter.
Yeah.
But that to his, the kind of the amazing beauty of his, you know, his kind of epiphany and, you know, his writings and stuff, I think is also, you know, we will talk about that as well, I think.
Yeah. I too am skeptical of the main man theory of history. Öcalan is very important in this story. He's not the only element of this story. There were, you know, there was a very advanced political culture in the PKK, particularly around women's autonomy and liberation and rights, which was advancing without Öcalan.
Right.
Öcalan gave the theory of democratic confederalism to the movement, to the PKK, and thus to the political forces that set up government, set up administration in Rojava. It's quite a complicated story, but in a sense, you can make an ideological thread from his conversion to democratic confederalism, to which is a kind of anarchism, a bottom-up system of government, a rejection of the formal state as a means of political organization. You can draw that thread to what's happening now in Rojava, and the institution of self-government in 2012.
So, tell us all about it then.
Well, as I say, it started in 2012 when Kurds, you know, for want of a better word, took power in northeast Syria, which, as I say, was predominantly Kurdish. And as a result of these ideas floating around in the PKK, a party called the PYD, which was the Kurdish sort of, I hesitate to say wing because it's separate from the PKK, but it was a Kurdish political party, began to institute the system of bottom-up self-government where the communal level, the village level, is the primary unit of political decision-making. And you only govern at the larger scale by administration. So all decisions in theory are taken at the communal level, and at the sort of regional level, only administration takes place. So it's the inverse of what we have in Britain, where all the decisions are taken by a tiny few in the centre and implemented at the local level. instead, decisions are taken, all decisions are taken at the local level and implemented when necessary by the centre.
Well, how would that, I mean, would, so let me start with the meetings at the local level then. I mean, would the people at that meeting have to be in the PYD?
Yeah, no, I mean, no, absolutely not. They're for everybody, all ethnicities, all language groups, all local people have a right to speak.
There's a very strong influence, emphasis on women as well, isn't it?
Very strong, that all institutions should be co-chaired by women, women should have an equal voice, et cetera, et cetera. Let's be clear, though, we're talking about the ideal here. Reality is not so clear. But in the ideal version and Öcalan's version, the communal level is the primary political unit and drives all political decision-making and are essentially autonomous. They only come together when necessary in a sort of confederal structure. They don't conform to a state structure. And many of the institutions that we traditionally associate with the state, such as justice and law and courts, are practiced locally at the communal level. So this is a very interesting aspect of what they're doing in Rojava, is that they have essentially instituted community courts and justice systems, what they call social reconciliation, social harmony, where social harmony is the goal rather than punishment.
Right. Well, because yes, justice. Yeah. I mean, because I think that's one of the things that I've been sort of debating with, and just sort of, I mean, I'm doing comedy about to a degree, is that we, you know, we think of our form of justice as being really the only one, but it's an intensely authoritarian form of justice. It's violent form of justice, and it's not, it's, as you say, it's not focused on redemption. It's focused on punishment, isn't it?
And or reconciliation. And, it's not focused on it's deeply adversarial. The guilty, the accused has to be guilty or not guilty. And the family of the victim are not centred in the process.
But I always think, like, in our system, if I decide not to wear trousers, ultimately men will come to my house, on underpants, I suppose, men will come to my house and beat me, won't they? And I'll be put in a, I'll be incarcerated, ultimately. Like, do you remember the naked Rambler? I don't know what happened to him in here, but they just constantly put him in prison into this incredible, you know, just because he wanted to walk about with no clothes on. And of course, you also, the corollary of that is you also get this massive machinery of state repression, don't you? Speed, you know, surveillance cameras, police, the courts,
a system, massive system, including prisons, that's the main manifestation of state power, along with the military. You know, it is the main construction, the things that put shape around our society, that creates rules and enforcement mechanism for those rules, that governs our every moment. You know, from the moment you're born, you are supposed to be registered with the state. If you don't register your baby's birth with the state, you are punished. You know, you pay a penalty. So it's from the very minute you enter the earth to the very moment your death is registered. So it's even after death that you're still under the control of the state.
And we think we're free. I'm not so sure.
No, nor am I.
So back to Rojava anyway.
Well, as I say, the main governing elements of it are the communal level, and those sometimes confederate to make decisions at the regional level. It's important to note that the representatives from the communal level who work at the regional level are recallable. They're only allowed to represent decisions that have been made at the communal level. So again, very different from our supposed representative democracy, as it's called, where we elect people to take decisions for us. In this system, in Rojava, we take the decisions and somebody goes and represents those decisions in a regional forum.
Right.
So, but the other, you know, big thing in Rojava is that this is a country at war. Mm-hmm. And Rojava, the system, the state, the body, sorry, not the state, the group, the system has been at war ever since it existed. And it's been at war primarily with ISIS, but also with Turkey. And that war has, to an extent, defined its political development and does to this day, in that the armed forces of Rojava which is the YPG, which is the male militia, and the YPJ, the female militia, have a kind of political role in Rojava, which is not necessarily connected to the communes. They're not run by the communes. They are connected to them, but there is a sort of central authority. It has an army leadership, and there is a centralized political body, the Syrian Democratic Council, which represents all of this. So if you meet an international representative, Rojava, say at the UN, which once I helped facilitate a couple of times at the UN Security Council, they will be a member of the Syrian Democratic Council, yeah, or perhaps a member of the PYD, which is the political party that drove all of this and still has, some would argue, too dominant a role in the political dispensation there.
Right. And if I think if for a while on our media, if there was a, there were stories about ferocious women fighters fighting ISIS, which I think, yeah, probably suited the agenda of the our establishment at the time. But they were all from Rojava, weren't they?
They were part of the female militia, the, yeah, YPJ. And as you're entirely right, they were kind of picked out and fetishized as a symbol of anti-ISIS resistance without telling the story of the society that they represented, because they see them, I've met some of these remarkable women, they see themselves as representatives of that society where women are equal, which of course is very, very different from the deeply patriarchal society that their society used to be and still predominates in most of the Middle East. So they very much see it as a model for the Middle East. But their story, you know, when you see representations of Rojava or of Kurds in everyday, in current day Syria, you will tend to see stories about these young women, you know, and because people
are completely decontextualized.
Completely decontextualized, yeah, yeah. In a way that is insulting to them. Mm. You're not privileging them. You're not doing them any favors by separating them and sort of calling them these remarkable women fighters. They are remarkable, but you've got to see them as part of a broader political phenomenon, yeah, which is very much about women's liberation. I mean, here we are, two middle-aged guys talking about women's liberation. We are well qualified, but it's really important to understand that Rojava, what's happened in Rojava, is to a considerable degree driven by women, and is about women's autonomy and equality.
So what does life look like then, you know, in terms of if I'm just an ordinary citizen in Rojava, but do I go to these meetings, these communal meetings?
Yeah, and you bring up I went to some of these meetings, and you bring up your concerns, whether it's the price of medicine, or kids cycling their bikes too fast through the village, or pollution from the local petroleum refinery. You bring up your concerns, and these are discussed.
Right.
And in theory, this leads to political decision making that addresses your concern. The issue that has arisen in Rojava, and we probably ought to be clear that Rojava isn't exactly the correct name for it, because Rojava is the Kurdish name, right, for that region of the world. And this area is multi-ethnic, and the administration that we're talking about is multi-ethnic. And it calls itself the Autonomous Administration of Northeast Syria, AANES. We get stuck in, you know, it's acronym city, and they change, yeah, them all the time. So it can get very confusing. But what we're talking about is Northeast Syria, basically, and the Autonomous Administration of Northeast Syria. And that is based on the commune. And in theory, decisions are made at the communal level and only when necessary implemented higher up. But the criticism that has emerged from more on the ground research is that the centre is still too dominant, partly because it's a war situation, yeah, it's a war economy, and the military have a very strong voice, but partly because the PYD, the political party that drove all of this, is too dominant, and its members are privileged. That's the criticism. I don't know how true it is.
Right.
What we really lack is good quality on the ground reporting. There's some really good academics who've been there, done some good quality work, but for those of us who very much believe in the Rojava Northeast Syria experiment, I think it's important that we get to see good quality data about what's going on, what the problems are. I don't think anybody pretends that it's perfect.
Right.
But ideologically, at least, it is striving for something that many of us really believe in.
And what's so, I know that, I mean, to an extent, the Kurds were abandoned by the United States a few years ago militarily. I mean, what's the military? I mean, and they have so many enemies, don't they? Syria, fucking Erdogan, Turkey, the estates,
ISIS,
yeah.
Northern Iraq, you name it. I mean, they're surrounded by enemies. But the US is still there. They did, under Trump, the US did withdraw from Syria. And that led to a lot of protests, above all from the US military, of all people, because they saw the YPG, the Northeast Syria militia, as an important ally in the fight against ISIS, a very successful ally who'd conquered much of the territory, like Kobani, Hasaka, other towns which had been occupied by ISIS and run by ISIS. And the YPG, with American support, particularly air support, had retaken these towns and established an area of territorial control that was free of ISIS. And the ISIS problem is not gone away, even though plenty of people had declared the defeat of ISIS. There's still sleeper cells mounting attacks and bigger attacks taking place. There's also the problem of huge numbers of ISIS prisoners who nobody wants to.
Because I mean, the Kurds are, like, for instance, I've forgotten their name. The girl who was 15 who went from East London to is she being held in Rojava?
I've
forgotten their name.
Begum.
She
is being held in Rojava. In Northeast Syria.
Really effectively where she's been dumped by the British state, really, who doesn't want to deal with the contradictions.
She's been stripped of her citizenship.
And
the British state doesn't want her back, but it's been left for the Kurds in Northeast Syria dispensation to deal with her. And what the hell are they supposed to do with her?
Yeah.
Imprison her for the rest of her life. But just to go back to the geopolitics of this, the US is still militarily present in Northeast Syria. It has a base in Northeast Syria. And they are cooperating with the YPG in fighting ISIS. They are also, it must be said, and this is not said by the Americans, but it is true, that they are a deterrent against Turkish invasion of Northeast Syria. I think if it were not for the Americans, there is a good chance that Northeast Syria would have been overrun by Turkey. Whether that is still a possibility. I mean, this beautiful experiment could end at any moment Turkish assault. And as we say, Rojava is surrounded by enemies. It's got Turkey to the north. The Kurdish administration in northern Iraq is not sympathetic to them, has blockaded them. And, of course, to the west, they've got the Syrian regime, with whom they maintain a very uneasy peace. They don't actually fight the regime, but they are not in cooperation with the regime.
Why are the Kurds in Iraq so hostile?
That's a good question, because you would think there'd be some solidarity between the Kurds. Because they want a modus vivendi with Turkey. The PKK is based in northern Iraq, in the mountains, the Kandil Mountains, and Turkey attacks them, bases troops in northern Iraq, and puts an awful lot of pressure on the KRG to maintain that aggressive posture in northern Iraq. But the government in northern Iraq is not a particularly great government. It's corrupt. It's not really very democratic. It doesn't subscribe to the ideology of the PYD and what they're attempting to do in the AANES. And indeed, it has its own groupings, the KNC, and yet another acronym for you, which is an offshoot of one of the northern Iraqi political parties. Let me get this straight, the KDP. And so they are fighting for influence in northern Iraq. So it's still a very, very volatile situation, where this self-governing administration is very much under threat. Above all from Turkey, and Turkey has stepped up its attacks in recent months. Erdogan has been very clear that he wants to attack them and retake that territory and eradicate what he calls
which is not threat. In Turkey.
No, It's in Syria. Yeah. Well, Turkey already occupies a significant band of territory in northern Syria along the Syrian-Turkish border, as well as an area called Afrin, which is a predominantly Kurdish area in northwest Syria, which was governed autonomously until Turkey invaded a few years ago. So Turkey already holds a substantial chunk of territory, and Erdogan has made clear he wants to expand that. He wants to wipe out what he calls the PKK, which is the YPG, because he says the PKK and the YPG are essentially the same thing, that they are militarily united.
I mean, Erdogan's quite, I mean, he plays everybody up against everybody else, doesn't he?
The
you know, he's got alliances with the states, in a sense, with Russia, with Israel.
He's a very dangerous man. And you only have to look at Turkey's own internal human rights record and the treatment of the Kurds above all to see the true colours of this administration, of this regime.
There also is a member in good standing of NATO.
Yes, yeah. That's what we're standing with in NATO.
Yeah. I've
got no doubt that Turkey should not be a member of NATO.
No.
But
it's carried out many massacres, like in Afrin. Yeah. And,
the human rights abuses continue to this day. But Turkey is given a free pass by the West, by the Europeans, because it stopped refugees crossing over into the EU. Basically, that's why we let the Turks off the hook and stay quiet about their human rights abuses and their abominable behaviour in Syria and all the other things. You know, Erdogan is busy courting Putin at the moment. He's met Putin twice in the last few weeks. Nobody knows what they actually discussed. One shudders to think these two creeps getting together. But, you know, Syria was certainly on the agenda. And Erdogan was certainly looking for permission from Russia to attack Syria, to attack northeast Syria, where the Russians in the past have been reluctant because they want to sustain the Assad regime. Their priority in Syria is sustainment of the Assad regime. It's a complicated picture.
Yeah. What should people do if they want to learn more about, one, learn more about Rojava, and two, support it, I suppose?
There's a good information source called the Rojava Information Center, RIC, that has fairly up-to-date news about Rojava. You can follow them on Twitter as well. Media News carries a lot of news about the MEDYA, carries a lot of news about Kurdish issues. There's a good book about the political economy of Rojava called Make Rojava Green Again, because one thing we haven't talked about is the ecological element of what they're attempting to do with the economy in Rojava, which is based on Öcalan's ideas, which are then in turn based on the ideas of a guy called Murray Bookchin,
right,
who was an American political thinker who some call him an eco-anarchist. He rejected the title of anarchist, but he basically came up with the idea that domination of man over man, of hierarchy, is intrinsically connected to our domination of nature. So in order to have an ecological society, we have to abandon hierarchy and domination and vice versa. And that is one of the essences of democratic confederalism, which is Öcalan's thesis of political philosophy, which owes a lot to Murray Bookchin.
Right. And I suppose then we come, I mean, because one of the, not necessarily one of the themes of this podcast since it started has been to try and find a way, in a very haphazard way, to try and find an ideology that can somehow lead us forward, I think.
Yeah.
Early on, we wanted to talk about anarchism in Spain.
Yeah.
I talked to Professor Paul Preston about that. Yeah. Unfortunately, his politics are quite...
Oh, mate.
Yeah, so he wasn't really that... he didn't really... I mean, it was a fascinating talk about Spain, and he's a very interesting guy, but he didn't really... he didn't offer that much that was positive about anarchism in Spain, really. We sort of never quite circled back to that. But also, that is part of the search of this podcast, I think. And one of the things that I've become obsessed with is the Labour Party. And the previous guest I had on was a young guy who'd worked in Jeremy Corbyn's office briefly. And what we talked about really was the utter inadequacy of the Labour Party, of its of its political thought, but also of its membership, in a sense, particularly at the top level. Jeremy had his flaws, obviously, but they were very much, he was also betrayed by, I think, the people around him, a lack of clarity, I suppose, but just the utter uselessness of the Labour Party as a tool for progress, I think. But so, and also as a tool for, you know, this crisis which we're rapidly approaching, the, you know, ecological collapse, climate collapse. Yeah. And what I've been searching for really is a way in this country and worldwide, I suppose, to a real, you know, I mean, also I, like Öcalan, having been former Marxist-Leninist myself, I also completely reject that kind of authoritarian communism because it simply doesn't work. So yeah. I'm hoping that you're going to fix everything.
I've got the answer, Alexei.
You've got the answer.
You've come to the right place.
Thank God for that book, Ruben Shepherd-Bush.
I am, in fact, writing a book about it, which I hope to put out fairly soon, called What Is To Be Done, which tries to state in very simple terms an answer to this crisis, which is both an ecological crisis and a democratic crisis. And you're quite right, the Labour Party doesn't have an answer. It is offering more centralised politics, majoritarian politics, when what we need is people to develop autonomy from the bottom up. People want agency. They want control over their own lives. And we need to reform capitalism so it stops destroying the planet. And there is a way to do this. I talk about it in the book. Which is basically degrowth, that we have to abandon growth as the central objective of the economy, that we should go for a well-being economy. We should look to other sources of fulfillment.
On the news they say, growth's only been, you know, it's a catastrophe. Growth's only been 0.3% or something. I think, what's good about growth? You know, growth means more in terms of less rainforest, means less.
Yes, absolutely. In terms of carbon emissions, growth is very bad.
Yeah.
And if we are to reduce carbon emissions enough to save the planet to keep to 1.5 or 2 degrees centigrade, we have to stop growing. We have to grow less. We have to
produce. Because that dickhead Starmer's talking about a high growth economy.
Well, he's still convinced of the green growth thesis, which is you can grow and convert the economy to renewables and green and ecologically sustainable basis, and that the evidence is that you can't. At the moment, what we have is the economy is growing, carbon emissions are growing less fast, so there is relative decoupling, as it's called, but there isn't a decline in carbon emissions. And what we need is an absolute decline to zero in carbon emissions, and the only way to do that is to end consumerism, basically. Stop a materialist basis for society. We need a spiritual renewal. We need a conversion to seeing the objective, our collective objective, more about, to me, the ineffable things of community, meaning, love, rather than consumption and materialism. So that I see as a necessary part of this. And in my view, that conversion can only happen when we have a real bottom-up democracy where people are able to declare what they really want, because when you ask people what they really want, they do not say growth. They say, I want to be comfortable, want my kids to have a better future, but above all they say things like their family matters to them, their friends, meaning, community, stuff that does not have a measure. And we need to allow that voice to come out of the democratic system, and that means an end to a centralized democratic system. So these two things, as Bookchin argued, and my philosophy is quite a Bookchinite philosophy, the renovation of democracy is necessary for a renovation of capitalism, or rather the end of representative democracy is necessary if we are to end capitalism.
So what would that look like on the ground then, if you look?
Well, similarly to Rojava, we would govern ourselves at the lowest possible level, which would be the communal level, which would be the town or the village. And this has been done in other places other than northeast Syria. In Porto Alegre in Brazil, for example, they had mass participation in debates about how to prioritize the city budget, which led to dramatically different outcomes in terms of the equality of the provision of services and indeed the end of political party politicking. So it can be done. This isn't,
I think one of the things, the potential of this kind of system is it also weeds out what I talk about a lot is just
particularly on the right Labour Party, it's just the terrible arseholes.
Yeah.
Get into positions of power.
Politics attracts arseholes.
Yes.
I mean, it attracts exactly the wrong kind of people.
Absolutely.
You know, I've been around them. I wrote speeches for them.
Yeah.
You know, selfish, egotistical people who think of nothing else but their own success.
Yeah.
That's what largely the political,
yes.
Not solely, there's some very, very good people in politics, some very well motivated people. So one doesn't want to generalize too much. But,
well, no, I'll generalize.
You know, what we want is the system where everybody feels they have a voice,
yeah.
Everybody has agency, even the most marginalized. And there's no question that an awful lot of people in the current dispensation from both right and left feel cheated. They feel that they're cut out of the decisions that matter to them. Okay, well, what's the answer? Give them those decisions.
Right.
And along with the Butchernite thesis, you basically take decisions at the local level about everything. Where necessary, you aggregate those decisions through a confederal organization. It is plausible. It has been done in past societies. This is not beyond the wit of man to build such a society. It is not beyond the wit of man to build an economy where well-being and ineffable things like community and love are our goals rather than growth. These are plausible objectives. It is quite a radical change. Yes, I grant you, but we are in radical trouble.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's one of the things that, I mean, sometimes I think that the left can come across as very whiny, you know, oh, everything's so. But what you have to offer is to say, love, is to say, you'll be happier. It's not just that you're doing the right thing, you know.
Yeah.
You got to do on NHS. You know, it's like it's not an obligation. It will make everybody happier.
It's better. It's a better society. We will be happier. We will flourish. It's a view. I mean, this is what for me is so profound about this anarchist philosophy. It's a view of how to live. It's much more than just how do you distribute resources or take decisions about, you know, sewage. It's about how you live, how we relate to one another, that we get much more out of life when we are equal. If you think about the relationships that really matter to you, they tend to be the ones where you are equal in power to the other person.
Right.
And this is why our friends matter to us so much. We don't tend to make friendships at work because there is a hierarchy at work. We have a boss or we are the boss of somebody. And, you know, if you want, what is life about? It's about human relationships. It's about us being able to fulfill ourselves through whatever way that we choose, where we need to be free to make those choices. And the best way to do that is a society without hierarchy, where people live equally. And the start of that is where people have equal political power to decide their own circumstances. And this is the only way to do that, is to have a system of bottom up. And I hesitate to say bottom up because it implies there's a kind of center.
Yeah.
In many ways, there isn't a center.
Right.
The communal level, the local level has autonomy. It can make decisions for itself. And people say, oh, that's not possible in a complex society like the UK. You know, how do you decide motorways, the law, all this kind of stuff? Well, it is perfectly possible. And decisions at scale can be made in this confederal way that I've described. But I think ultimately it does mean the dismantling of the state. Because the state is a centralized authority based on a highly centralized hierarchical view of decision making, and in many ways embodies many of the worst things about authority and capitalism.
Yeah.
And are justified by the state. War, to start, you know, the only people allowed to use violence is the state.
Yes, monopoly of violence.
Why have we allowed that situation to be perpetuated? So ultimately, you know, you can foresee the end of the state. But to me, this is a gradual process of building these processes of autonomy from the bottom up.
So do you have a template for specifically how that can be enacted in a, you know, an advanced capitalist society?
It's exactly the right question, Alexei. And I have thought a lot about that. And I've talked to Murray Bookchin's daughter about that. I've looked at the Rojava example. I've looked at places like Barcelona and Brazil about how these things actually took place. And in Rojava, as I said, the regime kind of collapsed and the Kurds kind of took power and set up their own institutions, the communal level institutions. But interestingly, they had already established in quite wide areas of northeast Syria communal level institutions before that. And so I see the possibility of a process of people spontaneously starting their own assemblies, which would discuss things like the future of their local school, the future of their local hospital, which would attract legitimacy because people would take part. And they would have political power because people would take part. These would be inclusive things, carefully chaired, so everybody had a voice. And, of course, eventually there would be a confrontation with the entrenched system of democracy, your local council, your regional council, and indeed Westminster itself. And who has the greater authority in those moments will be contested. You know, that will be a confrontation. I very much believe that doesn't need to be with violence, but that there will be a cultural change from these assemblies, from the local level and perhaps at the national level, perhaps tipped over, where one phenomenon, one instance of this spreads like in a complex system, where the whole system tips over into a state where people want decisions for themselves. Because I passionately believe that what I want, which is a life of agency, where I have control over the things that matter to me, where I'm equal to the people who around me, I think lots of people want that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not radical. Also,
I think part of the offer, because these the institutions that would oppose you, in a sense, are just composed of people.
Yeah.
And you can say to oligarchs, I mean, it looks fucking miserable being an oligarch. It must be horrible, really.
Yeah, lots of people begging to you the whole
time. And you can't trust anybody, and you've got to wear all that fucking horrible fucking watch that weighs in. And you can't, you know, it's a lonely life, I think. You can't, you know, and it's also, you've done terrible things to get to to that position.
Ultimately,
and you can't, and we, you know, we can say to those people, you'll be happier if you give up this shit. You know, it shouldn't necessarily be opposition, because one of the things I always think is wrong about, you know, conventional left politics in a way, is seeing, you know, our opponents as the devil, and they're not. They're just unhappy.
They're just other people.
Miserable people.
Yeah. I do know several very rich people. I know like 5 billionaires, and they're not happy people.
No, it's a miserable fucking life.
And I think you're absolutely right, because to liberate ourselves, we have to liberate our oppressor.
Yeah.
We are liberating our oppressor, like a prison guard who is in many ways serving time like a prisoner. You know, the person enforcing the hierarchy and wielding power over everybody else is disfigured. When I had power as a civil servant, as a diplomat, I did terrible things that I'm ashamed of, and it disfigured me. It turned me into somebody I really wasn't. It didn't allow me to be my authentic self, including in moral terms.
Yeah.
And that power, this cliche, power corrupts, it's not that. It disfigures you. It transforms you into something ugly that you don't truly want to be. And once you're released from the duty of having power, you are truly free. This is what Lao Tzu was saying in the Tao Te Ching, which is arguably the original anarchist text, that freedom from power is true freedom.
Always comes back to Chinese martial arts. But I have to say, on this podcast, I'm always right on the edge of my knowledge. I'm a terrible fraud in many ways. I mean, I talk about the right.
We all are.
But me more than me more than most. The great skill of the comedian is sounding like they know shit that they don't really. So, but
well, we're all playing that game, Alexa.
I guess we are.
Not just comedians. Yeah. You're in good company.
Well, thank you for that reassurance. Do you see a place for where does conventional parliamentary representative politics fit into this, if anywhere?
Ultimately nowhere, because representative democracy, which I don't call democracy, is not part of the vision. It's the opposite. It's electing a small group of people to run the affairs of the many. I do see an opportunity, though, for a radical party to emerge that says we are going to make this change, though that does go against a principle, a political principle, which is very important, which is the means are the ends. If you say we're going to take political power in Westminster as a means to the end to get rid of political power in Westminster, you're slightly contradicting yourself.
Yes, and that contradiction.
And there is, you know, the Green Party believes in radical decentralization. It also believes in a well-being economy and the abandonment of growth as a central objective.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are parties that would choose
the Green Party, certainly in Germany, has played a very reactionary role in government, as it has been.
To an extent, you're absolutely right, but Germany is already a more decentralized country, much more decentralized than Britain, and has a much more consensus-based politics. It's still a top-down politics, and the Green Party has not radically reformed it, but, you know, it's making a big difference to the German economy, that's for sure. in terms of their green plans, setting an example we would be good to follow. But that's not the ultimate vision of change that I'm after. You know, and I do think there's a possibility of some clever politician emerging and exploiting this rage that there is out there at the current political situation. Unfortunately, I think it's more likely to be a right-wing populist than a left-wing communalist who exploits that.
But that's one of my objections to people is somebody like Starmer or, you know, Obama, for instance. If you offer people hope and change and then deliver neither, then you block off the left space. So people are sent right, aren't they, as a kind of as a place to find radical change of a terrible.
Well, in America, the anti-government view has become very much associated with the right wing, and pro-government is very much the liberal, quote unquote, view, which is very unfortunate because I think libertarianism has been co-opted by the right.
That's the fault of what you might call the left in a sense.
Yeah. Really. Well, Bookchin called himself a libertarian municipalist. To get yet more jargon into here.
Always welcome.
You know, and arguably you could call this philosophy a kind of libertarian socialism. But the term libertarian is problematic because for many people, particularly in America, it just means a complete rejection of government and authority and the right to do whatever you want, make as much money as you want, and be an anarcho-capitalist, if you like. Whereas my version of anarchism is very much a cooperative one based on equality in society, where we attend to the needs of those most vulnerable first, and that they are centered in our decision-making.
And again, we don't do that because it makes your life better. It's not because of some kind of airy-fairy goodness in a sense. It's just better for us all to do that, isn't it?
It's what I find so frustrating. It's why I'm so urgently trying to get this book out. It's because I feel this is better.
Yeah.
You know, I genuinely feel this offers a better alternative to the way we live. And what's so sad about the current situation is everybody sort of shrugs their shoulders and says, oh, well, nobody's put up an alternative. You know, there's no alternative to kind of moderated capitalism. And that's just not true.
Yeah.
People have come out with these ideas. And, you know, the anarchists, the 19th century anarchists, explored all these ideas very thoroughly. There's books and books and books about this stuff if you care to read them. And they took these ideas very seriously. And they saw them as plausible alternatives to the depredations and injustices of capitalism. And it is. We don't have to accept the system as it currently is. We can start to build. And it's the other thing I like about it, it's not just ideology, which, you know, Marxist-Leninism often becomes. It is about practice. In Rojava, we see these ideas in practice. And that's why it's such an important example for everybody else, because this is about what you do as your politics, not what you think. It doesn't, you know, our politics has become voting once every 5 years, you know, which is a farce. That's not political participation. That's a tokenism. That's a fraud. Real politics is what you do every day in your choices and how you treat people. That's what anarchism is about. It's what Lao Tzu was on about. It's about our everyday interactions with other people, how we relate as a society, and how that manifests politically is through an equalitarian, non-hierarchical political system.
I'm all for that. Do you think you want to plug?
I plugged, didn't I?
Yeah, you plugged the book.
Shamelessly dropped that in.
What is to be done, which is what's to be done too, after Lenin wrote, also wrote.
Yes, and he copied a novel by Chernyshevsky called What is to be Done. So it's part of a long series of What is to be Done.
Lenin nicked material off other people. Oh, dear.
Shameless.
Bad comic. I think, you know, in a way we've got everything. I mean, there's a lot to think of on there, really. I would have thought there'd be follow-up from the listeners or whatever.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Dalal was just wondering what part religion plays in all. I mean,
that's a really interesting question. I thought a lot about that because I was very much an atheist and very much took a scientific view of life that unless you could prove it scientifically, it didn't matter, a rationalist view of life. And anarchists too reject religion. They saw it as part of hierarchy, and no gods, no masters was a slogan for a reason. And what they were against, though, really is religion, not necessarily spiritualism, organized male-dominated religion, which was used as a tool of political oppression. And it, it it does occur to me, and there are quite a lot of people in my camp who believe that we need a spiritual renaissance for this to happen. The renaissance of capitalism, of the adoption of a new system, requires a kind of spiritual crisis.
Yeah, and I always think, I mean, one of the templates, organizational templates I sometimes talk about is Alcoholics Anonymous, really, because I think they've got a really interesting way of organizing things.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's allowed to talk, or encouraged not to talk for more than 3 minutes, for instance, which is a good thing. But also it's a, in a sense, Alcoholics Anonymous has always emphasized that it has to be a spiritual organization as well as a, you know, there has to be a spiritual element within this struggle.
Well, I think
personal liberation, but then, but, you know.
That's right. And I mean, I think whenever you're talking about a political system or an economic system, that the question arises, what's it for? You know, what is life for? And I think, you know, the materialist scientistic view of life is that basically it's not for anything.
Right.
You know, it's a pretty bleak view of existence. We're just, you know, lonely atoms in a massive indifferent universe. And I think part of my transformation has been a recognition that there is a spiritual element to this, that it doesn't have to be through organized religion. It can be your own path. It could be through, you know, dozens of different ways, you know, from martial arts to dance music. But you've got to find something.
I agree. I think our movement, as it were, has to, embrace that, I think, rather than...
Well, it's part of the rejection of materialism.
I mean, that is, Dawkins kind of...
Yeah, and I'm very much against that view. It's so dismissive as well. It's so sneering at other people. I really dislike that intolerance of it. Even if I am an atheist, even if I don't particularly believe in God, I do believe that people have spiritual needs. And I don't trivialize that. I take that very seriously. And people have found very profound answers to those questions. And I respect that. And I do think that if we are to abandon capitalism, we have to find a non-materialist view of life, a view that respects immaterialism, where the things that are most important to us are not given material measure. And that's what I do profoundly believe, that Wittgenstein came to that conclusion in his Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, that the most important things could not be talked about, could not be measured. There was no language that could describe them. And that's what I too believe. He was a kind of Christian. He did believe in organized religion. I don't. But I do think he was right, that these are the most important things. And if they are the most important things, our society should be organized around promoting them, those things, those immaterial things, not material consumption.
Yeah. Testify, brother. Well, I think that's, you know, I agree with everything you say.
Great. Great.
So let's get this shit done, people.
That's a good quote for the book. Thank you.
Yeah. And how many subscribers have we got now? 12,000 or something? Come on, subscribers. Fucking get this shit done. We've waited too long. I'm 70 now. I haven't got much longer. Fucking to reform the fucking world. Karen Ross, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Alexa. Thank you for having me.
Ah, a lot to think about there, and I'd be interested in your reactions.
Yeah.
Talal, you were going to read some more
stuff. Yeah, if you've got any thoughts on that, email us at alexisalepodcast@gmail.com, or if you're a member of our Patreon, which is patreon.com/alexisalepodcast, if you're a supporter there, which we... if you can afford to, please do join their throng.
We would like your money, sir.
Can send us messages on
give
there.
Give us tuppence, sir. If you could just give me tuppence, sir, for me Patreon, I'd be very grateful, sir. If you could just for me podcast, sir.
Oh, please. If you haven't got a penny, a halfpenny will do.
Yes, for me podcast, sir.
And you can send us messages
feed
there.
The podcast, tuppence a bag.
James messaged us on Patreon. He goes, "All right, you bastards. Blind Boy one made me get my wallet out. Keep it up." Oh, nice.
Good man.
So Blind Boy was a big money bringer. Karina just listened to the Blind Boy episode, which was, as usual, fantastic. sellout stuff was a moment of, oh my God, how had I not noticed that? Oh yeah, because we were talking about how selling out isn't really a thing anymore. Oh my God. And then she writes a short essay about the 1944 Education Act.
All right. Okay. All right. Okay. I'd like to see that.
Oh, I'm just kind of reading it silently now. I'll send that to you. And if you have any thoughts, we'll bring that up on the next episode. But she says, anyway, love the show. You're as wonderful as you always were, Alexi. She can't wait for the next series of Imaginary Sandwich Bar.
Yeah, recording in September and going out in, I think, October or November.
Oh, la la. Evening, Alexi and Talal. Clearly a big fan of the podcast, but he wants to, this is Ian, he wants to pass on his thanks for Strangers on a Train. And I have to say so too. It's a really refreshing
listen. Yeah, hopefully we'll be doing more of those.
He listened to all the journeys on his holiday, and it's the best thing he's heard on radio since, guess what? Sandwich Bar. Simple idea, expertly executed.
So email the BBC with that, with those feelings.
Congratulations, must get recommissioned. Thank you, Ian.
Yes.
Jay. The latest interview with Phil Bevins, he writes Philip Bevins, was amazing. Looking forward to part two. Lots of calls for part two with Phil.
Yeah, I've forgotten. What's part two supposed to be about?
Just more shit
about the late party. Well, I'm always up for that. I've just been reading a book called I Want to Believe, which is about the Posadists, who are a group of Trotskyists who had a very strong position on UFOs.
Oh,
wanted a nuclear war because they thought that would bring about the revolution, but they also felt very strongly that had a very strong position about
I have a friend like
travel.
This. He's
really?
The most lefty person I know.
Right.
But is vehemently believes in aliens, UFOs, crop circles. He says like he knows some of them are hoaxes, but you can't explain all of them. And how do you explain the pyramids? Like he seems like he is very well educated and really smart guy, and he often enlightens me on things I had no idea about.
Right.
And then he'll throw out these theories.
If anybody's, maybe let's see if anybody, I don't know if we got an expert in Posadism, or that kind of strain of left wing thought might be interesting. If there's anybody out there wants, but also strangely enough, I was meeting a friend in Regent's Park and was sitting on a bench reading this book, and a young American jogged by, and then he came back and he said, "That's the greatest book ever written." He said,
wow.
"It's amazing." And then as he jogged off, he said, "Victory to the movement."
My God.
Yeah. And that's just like, you know, which was extraordinary.
American.
In Regent's Park. And so I don't know whether anybody's interested in that stuff, really. I mean, it's for me, the book is about the ultimately the tragic aspects of left-wing thought, you know, and left-wing failure. But I don't know if people are interested in Posada. We could maybe have an episode on that.
And maybe
if we could find an expert.
That sounds really interesting. Maybe you and I could do a book swap when I'm done with this. I think
you'd
like this one. It's called The Bonnot Gang by Richard Parry.
Oh, right. Yeah.
If Richard Parry is still around, I think he'd be fascinating to come on the show and talk about these guys, because these dudes are, they've got a great story, The Bonnot Gang. French anarchists. And one more from Patreon. Conrad says, top-notch podcast, Alexi and Talal. Keep up the good work. More guns and tanks, please.
Yeah, well, we're talking about going to Bisley, aren't we, in November to actually do a kind of on our YouTube channel. I suppose this would be we're going to rifle shoot and handgun shoot, a black powder handgun shoot, as I assume, with separate ball and cap. We're going to shoot handguns, antique handguns.
I'm equally excited and scared. I have never.
I'm going to shoot 22 long rifle and various other calibers.
I've shot paintball guns. I've shot laser quest guns, but never a gun.
Well, this will be a first. It's, you're the only Syrian who hasn't.
Fuck you. We had a nice email from Priya saying, more swearing, please. Don't listen to the haters. Thank you, Priya. And lastly, I just want to give you some more praise and give you some good feelings about our show, because I've never mentioned it, but our iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever you call it these days, is riddled with beautiful, beautiful reviews. Thank you, everyone. Whatever podcast app you use to listen to this, it really does help to leave a rating and a review. If you're listening on the YouTube, because the podcast goes up on there too, give us a thumbs up and a comment. I feel icky saying that stuff, but it does help the algorithm. But some of the reviews, damn good, interesting listen. Highly recommended. Shame there isn't a Dr. Martin's Boots soundtrack. Well, my brother made a great soundtrack for us, and it's original. Thanks a million for the fascinating and enjoyable discussions. Love the one on Brecht. Would be pleased to learn more about cabaret culture during the Weimar Republic, particularly politics.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear a bad review?
No.
Okay.
Why would I want to hear back
as a lifelong Alexia aficionado, I thought the Brecht podcast was truly outstanding. Well, thank you. A jewel of a podcast, Alexia and Talal have made a great little podcast, an area of free thought and musing that always surprise and always inform.
That's We're fucking lovely. Great, aren't we?
That's really lovely. Spy Cops Like Us was really something. It's good to hear raw, unfettered Alexi. And lastly,
well, you get a lot more of that sandwich bar.
Oh, cool. And lastly, why no pic of Talal on description? Hard worker, that lad.
Yeah, put a picture up if you want.
Boy, no, it's not the Talal podcast.
No, that's true.
Well, there we go. I think that's everything I've got to read now.
Yes.
And funnily enough, the last two episodes, this one and the last one, you got those guests
organized
and everything. So thanks for taking the load off my shoulders.
You're welcome. I don't know what the next one's going to be about, but it'll be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever it is.
Oh, absolutely. Can't wait.
It's gonna be incredible. So, bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing, and to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.